Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Kia ora koutou, it's Marianne and Morin here with Bookends, another week of three fabulous New Zealand books to celebrate, and a reminder to get your tickets for Rawa.
Absolutely. The Akaroa Festival happening from the 6th to the 8th of March. It's full of some of our very favourite writers, Lawrence Fearnley, Damien Wilkins, Kate DeGoldy, Joe Bennett, Steve Brawnius.
Get in now.
Yes.
There are still a few spots around in the festival. So, but if you don't get to Rawa, you can enjoy hearing authors interviewed on Bookends. And this week we have Hannah Bullock to start with. Hannah has written an extraordinary social anthropology, history, family memoir about her family's, her mother's childhood adventure with her family overland, driving overland to the island of Skye. And it is magnificent.
Yes, it looks and sounds like a great book. And then I'm talking with Diana Morrow, who's written a very perceptive and interesting biography of the poet Ruth Dallas, a quiet Southlander who has left us with some extraordinary work.
That was a fascinating interview to listen to you recording, Morin, so I really encourage people to find out about Ruth. And finally, I'm talking to Nina Nola, who has documented her childhood and development within the West Auckland Dalmatian community and her struggle to make sense of the bonds of family when there's all that passion rolling around. Hannah Bullock is a social anthropologist with Otago University with a master's in creative writing. Overland to the Island, her new book, brings these two disciplines together in order to tell a dramatic chapter in her family's own extraordinary story. It's a compelling study of the power of Highland clan culture across generations of Scottish diaspora. It traces the bonds between Aotearoa Second World War servicemen and Italian communities. It's an insight into a family culture created around a certain Pākehā Kiwi post-Second World War southern masculine identity. It paints the picture of Aotearoa's remote place in the world in the early 60s, while narrating a travel adventure that would remain momentous by today's standards, but in the context of the times was nothing short of harebrained, obsessive, genius. With fabulous primary source material from multiple family diaries, photos and interviews, newspaper files, and exhaustive contextual research about the places and people encountered, this is a book to be savoured. I'm delighted to be interviewing Hannah on Bookends this morning. Tēnā koe. Welcome.
Tēnā koe. Thank you for having me, Marianne. I really appreciate being here.
Cool. So, Hannah, let's fill the listeners in on the basic story and characters here. We will dive into more detail as we go, but to get us started, just introduce us to Alan and to your grandmother, to their lives in 1962 Dunedin, and to the adventure that Alan took their family on.
Yeah, sure. So, Alan was my grandfather and Joan, my grandmother, and they lived on a farm on the outskirts of Dunedin. They married soon after the Second World War and ended up buying a very rundown, ramshackle kind of a farm and built it up and had six children. But when my grandfather had been fighting in the Second World War, he had had the opportunity to visit the Isle of Skye, where his ancestors were from, his MacLeod ancestors. And he wanted to go back there. And so in 1962, he started building a house truck out of a collection of old military vehicles on the farm, and decided to take his family for a very unusual trip around the world.
Yeah, overland from?
Overland. So they started in Dunedin and travelled north to Wellington, and then put their house truck on a ship to Singapore, and then set about trying to travel overland insofar as they could from Singapore to Scotland.
Indeed. And I love that the prologue starts with Lynn of Tawa, Jeanette MacDonald, interviewing Alan, your granddad, for the Great New Zealand Man Doco, the quintessentially resourceful Kiwi joker, her search for that fellow. And obviously there's tons to admire about Alan, but he's not an easy patriarch to bear with. So being quintessentially resourceful is one thing if you're a war-hardened, you know, 40-something-year-old man, but it's another for his wife and his six young children. Can you just tell us what was required of the family, really, to bring his dream to fruition?
Yeah, so I guess in some sense there's a bit of controversy within my family regarding how to interpret my grandfather and their father, because to some of his children, he was, you know, an amazing, heroic kind of man. And to others, he was a bit of a selfish old bastard, because he kind of single-mindedly pursued his own aspirations and interests, and sometimes that came at the expense of other family members, and particularly my long-suffering grandmother, Joan. So, you know, the cottage that they lived in on the farm, it was an old 1860s cottage, and it was very run down. When snow would melt on the roof, water would run down the walls and pool beneath the house. Initially, there were holes in the floor, and they, when they started out there, they didn't have electricity. They only had they just had a well, and then a single tap. And, you know, my grandmother had this tiny kitchen, and there was no indoor bathroom. Initially, there was just a long drop. And so my grandmother was trying to, you know, raise six children, and my mother is the eldest. You know, she said to me sometimes she felt like Cinderella doing all the cooking and cleaning, or not all the cooking and cleaning. She was helping her mother, but she said, you know, she didn't have a normal childhood in a sense. She didn't have time to play. And then, you know, I get the sense that it wasn't exactly, my grandmother wasn't initially in favour of the world voyage, but I guess my grandfather managed to convince her to go. And then, you know, they had to run a household essentially on the road in this house truck that my grandfather had built for over a year. So it was a big burden.
Yeah,
him as well.
And as a woman today, there's you know, I feel this intolerance and that kind of blinkered indifference to what his mission asked of those around him, you know, like this extraordinary admiration, but also that. And this kind of his, you know, his belief that he had a right to ask that of everybody and take credit for what they might get out of it. But I'm able to put it aside because this just wasn't some vacuous trip across Southeast Asia, was it? It wasn't, you know, like, you know, hippies discovering themselves. In its final destinations, it was actually a journey of connection to roots and to personal identity. Can you talk about that? What it meant for your grandfather, and your discovery?
Yeah. So I think that, I mean, my grandfather essentially had two goals when they were then. Well, I guess two destinations, two ultimate destinations in a sense. So one of them, as I mentioned, was to visit the MacLeod heartland on the Isle of Skye, and particularly Dunvegan Castle, and to revisit the clan chief, Dame Flora MacLeod. And he wanted his family to see this place where his own grandparents were from, and to kind of understand that connection they had to their heritage. But also, I think a second goal that had been perhaps eclipsed or forgotten over the years was that it was also really important to him to return to Italy and seek out people and places that he'd spent time in during the Second World War. And I was actually incredibly fortunate when I was researching the book to discover my grandfather's war diary, because almost no one knew that that he had kept a war diary. And during this this overland journey that they did in the 1960s, my mother also kept a diary, and she wrote in it every day. So I was able to cross-reference, in a sense, the places that they visited on that 1963 journey with the places that my grandfather had spent time in, and really see that they were going back to these places and meeting the same people and getting a sense maybe of why those places and people were so important to him. And I think he really wanted his family to understand the momentous sacrifices that New Zealanders had made during the Second World War. But I think he also wanted them to, you know, have that opportunity to travel, because that had been so important to him, and to learn about different cultures and meet different people as they went along.
Mm. So, you know, as well as that personal meaning, it was also, of course, simply this incredibly exciting, intrepid, eventful, and ultimately quite dangerous journey along the way. Yeah. Can you describe some of that, you know, maybe some of their Southeast Asian experience, but then also tell us about that fateful encounter in central India with Mary Lou?
Yeah, so I mean, we would think about traveling somewhere like Thailand today as being, you know, fairly conventional and absolutely on the beaten track. But back when the MacLeods were travelling through Southeast Asia in the early 60s, that was absolutely not the case. So they started out from Singapore, crossing the causeway into what was then Malaya, and then travelling north up toward Bangkok. But at the time, there was actually no proper road running all the way from Kuala Lumpur to Bangkok. So partly what they were going through was a bulldozer trail that was earmarked for the highway. And it was incredibly muddy in places. There were vehicles that had gone off the road, and repeatedly Alan and family had to, you know, because they had this, as I say, this vehicle that was partly made out of old military vehicles, so they were able to kind of tow people out of ditches and so forth. And at that time, there was also this fear of communist rebels around everywhere, so they had to sleep in police compounds as they travelled up through Thailand as well.
It's remarkable story. And you talk about, you know, there's record of elephants lumbering out of the forest in front of them, having to measure kind of log bridges for the width of their tire trucks. I mean, you know, and then just kind of creep over rivers on this, you know. Yep. It's an extraordinarily intrepid undertaking. But then they get to India. Talk to us about what happens there.
Yeah, so then they get to India, and the kind of, I guess, damage that the vehicle had sustained going over very rough roads in the months leading up to that might have contributed to what was a near catastrophic accident that they had. And they were very fortunate that a missionary nurse happened to be living nearby who came to their rescue. And so they ended up spending about a month with her, and yeah, just had, I guess it was such a meaningful encounter on both sides.
Your mother was very badly injured in that accident. Was the family member who sustained the most significant injuries in that, although they were all injured. How remarkable and fortunate that they were to have that happen somewhere where there was a hospitable, safe treatment option right there.
Yeah, and that's something that they reflected on to me often as I was talking to them about the trip. You know, they said that they really felt like someone was looking out for them that day, you know, even though this accident did happen. If it had happened, you know, even a few months later, Mary Lou wouldn't have been in that area.
She prayed for them to see divine intervention in it until her dying day, didn't she?
She did.
you know, like any good missionary would. So the trip to the Parliament of the McLeod clan at the end of this, you know, that was kind of the destination, it unravels slightly, doesn't it? Ending in this kind of unrelenting dash across the European leg of the journey. Can you just talk to us about that and about the subtext that you found in the diaries about the cost of that for your family?
Yeah, I think that there's various points in the diaries when this kind of tension comes out. That's one point at which it occurs, where you can kind of see that the children are very frustrated that they're, you know, driving through Greece, and Turkey and Greece, and through Western Europe. They want to stop to see these places, and Alan is rushing on.
No beach swims. No, you know, no souvlaki. This is just an 10-day driving mission.
And there are some doors slammed and windows smashed and things in the process, and a mention of somebody getting a hiding. And there's a few points like that where there is, as you say, a kind of a subtext within the diaries of frustration.
I found Alan's singularity of focus at that point. At other points, as I mentioned, I found it kind of gut-churning. And I'm very conscious that as a reader, I add all my own subcontext to the story that's different from how family are interpreting it. Did you struggle with wanting to depict the story as you saw it, with your own kind of subtext in there? Was there tension for you between celebrating the remarkable ingenuity and adventurousness with the more complex realities?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question. I think when I was writing it, it was important to me to allow or to give the reader space to make up their own mind, to do that as well as for me to bring out insofar as I could, the different voices and perspectives of my relatives. So I kind of tried to, I guess, step back and not draw too much explicit judgment. Maybe being a social anthropologist helped me a little bit there to kind of foreground other people's perspectives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think you managed that very delicately and very well without kind of backing away from anything. You present what's there. Then there's this joyous connection and reconnection in Italy once they kind of have been to the clan and come back. After that, then there's this grueling return to Aotearoa. Mm-hmm. And it really makes it obvious how far away we were, how remote New Zealand was in the day. It's really just comes so much to light. How do you think the family were changed by the adventure?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what you say about that kind of grueling aspect of getting home, because it was something that none of them actually remembered. Because I don't write about it in this book, but they actually did another world journey afterwards. And so it did kind of blur into one another for them. And so that was kind of a process of discovery for them, for my relatives, and reading the book, you know, and what I'd sort of found from diaries and other documents and to some extent from interviewing other members of the family about just how difficult it had been for them to get home at that point. But I think it did, the journey overall and both of the world journeys that they did change them profoundly. I mean, I think that for some of them, it completely altered their life course, probably. I mean, two of my uncles became great travellers after that and had travelled extensively around the world and and they're very engineering oriented as well, and I'm sure and very kind of problem solving oriented as well.
That intrepid spirit. I guess there's also the sense in the book that they were different from other Kiwi kids that they came home to be alongside because of that experience. Look, you have captured all of that with extraordinary accuracy and sensitivity, Hannah. Thank you. This fascinating book is a major achievement. Bookends and all our listeners, I'm sure, would join me in wishing you well on your own kind of journey. I understand you're facing some health challenges. Kia kaha, hold fast, indeed, which is the clan motto. The book is Overland to the Island by Hannah Bullock. It's published by Otago University Press. Get yours from any book retailer nationwide and enjoy the ride.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
You ask me what I'm saying in my poems. What am I saying? That everything is falling from us. We too are falling. And so this day, this hour, with the sun shining in its customary fashion and the wind blowing the trees, you and I, sitting behind windows discussing poems, this moment, every moment, falls, is falling. More precious than any fiery diamond is the flowering human heart, opening like a poppy head, and like a poppy, falling.
That was biographer Diana Morrow reading Iceland Poppies by Southland poet Ruth Dallas. Diana is an historian and editor who lives in Tamaki Makaurau. She has also written the biography of Kate Edgar, The Life of a Pioneering Feminist. And this latest work, chronicling the life of Ruth Dallas, has just been longlisted for this year's Ockham Book Awards for nonfiction. Diana, congratulations for that and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Maureen. It was very nice to hear that I was on the long list.
Well, yeah. Huge competition to be on that long list. So it really is an accolade for the book and the work that you've put into it. What attracted you to writing the life of Ruth Dallas?
Well, it was somewhat circuitous. My husband bought me a set of Charles Brash's diaries for my birthday. This is about 2020, 2021. And I found him commenting many times in the course of the diaries about this wonderful poet, Ruth Dallas. And I read quite a lot of poetry, but the name didn't really resonate. So I got a book of her poems out and I thought, oh, these are marvelous. Then I looked online to find out more about her. And there was no DNZB entry on her, which I found very odd. So I actually emailed the Ministry of Culture and Heritage and said, you know, there should be an entry on this poet because she's fantastic. She was quite acclaimed in her lifetime. And they said, well, would you like to write it? So I did. And in the course of writing it, I thought to myself, this actually warrants more than kind of 3 pages, this woman's life and her achievements. You know, the role that she played in a kind of a crucial stage in New Zealand's kind of cultural identity in the 50s with Landfall and so on, plus her work as a children's author. I thought, well, I could write a biography of her, and it's been a real pleasure from start to finish. Yeah.
She sounds like the sort of person it would be wonderful to sit and discuss poetry with, as she's alluding to in that poem.
Right.
Quiet, yeah. Intelligent, perceptive, and quite resolute in the way she lived her life.
That's absolutely right. She had she was quite sort of strong-willed and had a strong sense of what she wanted to do, what she thought, and how she was going to do it. And regardless of what were pretty, substantial hardships in terms of finances and so on, she stuck to it and, lived her life as a writer at a time when the whole sphere, creative writing, was very much dominated by men. And there were ideas about women poets that, as I pointed out in the book, were quite sort of narrow and stereotypical, yeah.
Yes, that whole 50s era when Alan Kuno was putting anthologies together along with other people like Dennis Glover, they were quite dismissive of the talents of women writers.
And even in the, I was quite surprised in some of the reviews of Ruth's work, the adjectives that are used are sort of painting women as sort of limited in their outlook and domestic. And, you know, there are all sorts of kind of stereotypes, I suppose, that were in play consciously or unconsciously. Not that she didn't get good reviews often, but I was quite struck by that in the course of working and how difficult it would have been. I mean, even when, for example, she was working for Brat, that was one great surprise to me in the course of my research. Her work on Landfall from 1961 to 65 was really like his editorial assistant. She was always described as his secretary, but she was, you know, she was looking at articles, she was editing them, she was reviewing things. When he was away, she was running the show, basically. I mean, he always kind of held the reins, but she had a huge amount of responsibility, really. And yet when he retired from the task, there was no question about her being even considered for the role, being a woman at that point in time.
Yes. I know. And he had a huge respect for her. And they were very close friends. I hadn't known that.
No, that's right. I think it's quite rare to get that sort of literary partnership. And when you read their papers, there's a lot of, you know, quite gloves off criticism of each other's work, but never any resentment and real mutual respect, which is lovely. And it was quite a really important friendship for her in the course of her life. He played a very influential role in drawing her into a world that she hadn't had any contact with in Invercargill, basically.
Yeah. Mm, because she didn't marry. The war kind of jinxed that and came to live with her mother in Dunedin, stayed, you know, when her mother died, her niece moved in. So she concentrated very much. She was inspired by and grounded in that Southland Otago area.
Oh, absolutely. It was everything to her, really. She only left, she very rarely left Southland and Otago. She had one overseas trip, a very brief conference in Australia. But she had very deep roots there, and her ancestral ties and her love of the landscape there were great motivations for her work. As anyone who reads her work can tell, yeah.
I had the pleasure and privilege of being able to dip into the new edition of her collected poems. So as I was reading your wonderful biography, inspiring biography, I could check out the poems as I went along, which is something I recommend. If you're going to buy Diana's book, please buy Ruth's book, the book of poems as well. But she also had a long-standing interest, a really deep interest in Eastern philosophies and Buddhism, Chinese poetry, and that really had a huge influence on her own poetry, didn't it?
That's absolutely right. The idea of sort of Buddhist philosophy of, you know, aspirational kind of selflessness and sort of cyclical nature, and also nature's as a sort of metaphor for the human condition, the cyclical nature of things. And also I think ancient Chinese and Indian poetry, the way the poets related to the landscape, so that it's not so much their ego that is at the forefront or their passions or whatever, but a kind of a more metaphysical look at man's relation to the environment and so on. And she related to that. She eventually, which is very, very interested in Buddhism, and at one point in time called herself a Buddhist, you know, in an interview. So I think it's a very important part of her work. And interestingly, when I first read her, when I was a teenager, I used to read Arthur Whaley's translations of Chinese poems. And when I first read her poems, I could tell that there was that sort of lovely song-like aspect, but also simplicity and accessibility, which is very much part of her work. I mean, I quoted somewhere, you know, life's too short for people to have to try figure out what a poem's saying. So she was always striving to write for people in a simple and accessible manner. Yeah.
Critics didn't always pick up her deep knowledge of Eastern thought and religion, did they?
No, and in fact, I mean, I argue in the book that even her first book, Country Road, is really deeply indebted to those ideas. But it's really not till The Turning Wheel, when you could hardly ignore some of the Buddhist symbolism of that stage of her work, yeah, that it's picked up. Yeah.
Now, a surprise to me was how much time and success she had in writing for children, contributing to the school journal, having books, you know, published overseas.
I know, it was fascinating. And actually, one of the things I think that motivated her was that when she was a child growing up in the 20s, there were no books. The kind of books that she wanted to read were about New Zealand children in New Zealand countryside having adventures, and she couldn't really find them. I think there was one writer called Isabel Maud Peacock, who she read, but the others were sort of overseas writers for the most part. And so that was one of her ambitions later on, and she did. She wrote exactly those sorts of books, very historically well-researched as well, I might add, yeah.
And that, you know, earned her some money. She generally lived on, you know, income from family.
Hard road being, you know, saying I'm dedicating myself to writing even now, unless you're massively successful. She put up with a great deal of hardship. But the children's books, you know, for a time in the 60s and 70s, she was making a pretty good salary on some of them. Yeah.
And ill health dogged her. She lost an eye when she was really young, which people say made her concentrate even more on what
lens.
She could see.
The reviewer said, sharpen the lens.
Yes.
More conscious of accurately describing things. Yes, I think it had a profound impact on her throughout her life. And she was, as you say, really plagued, but also quite sort of just her sort of fortitude in the face of ME and various sciatica, various things. She was always sort of saying, I'm going to bounce back. And I suppose that helped her bounce back.
She was a stoic without a doubt. We're going to end with you reading one of her very early poems, but one that earned her a huge amount of respect and has been anthologized. And
anthologized, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. Well, she wrote this poem as a result of being, during World War II, what was called a herd tester. So she was basically going, visiting dairy farms and testing the butterfat in milk. It was a job that she adored. This kind of draws on her experience of, you know, working in a dairy farm. Okay, I'll read it now.
Yes, I'd love you to.
Milking before dawn. In the drifting rain, the cows in the yard are as black and wet and shiny as rocks in an ebbing tide. But they smell of the soil, as leaves lying under trees smell of the soil, damp and steaming, warm. The shed is an island of light and warmth. The night was water cold and starless out in the paddock. Crouched on the stool, hearing only the beat, the monotonous beat and hiss of the smooth machines, the choking gasp of the cups and the rattle of hooves. How easy to fall asleep again, to think of the man in the city asleep. He does not feel the night encircle him, the grasp of mud. But now the hills in the east return, are soft and grey with mist. The night recedes and the rain. The earth, as it turns towards the sun, is young. Young again, renewed, its history wiped away like the tears of a child. Can the earth be young again and not the heart? Let the man in the city sleep.
Thank you, Diana. It's a remarkable poem. And thank you for reading that, Diana. I think the voice of Ruth Dallas comes through very clearly in that. And thank you for writing her life in this new biography, Ruth Dallas, A Writer's Life. Diana Morrow is the biographer, and it's published by Otago University Press. And alongside it, the collected poems of Ruth Dallas, edited by Nicola Cummins, and again published by Otago University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
To read The Way to Spell Love is to spend time with Nina Nola's soul on the page. We are inside her remembered observations and confusion as a child, struggling to make sense of an oppressive patriarchal family culture and of the bonds and tensions within an all-enveloping Dalmatian clan in West Auckland in the 1960s. We hear adolescent Nina and young adult Nina seeking the resolve to find her own way. We bear witness as she redefines her childhood and her connections to her culture through the prism of her gaining maturity when she falls in love and having children, bringing some truce, new truce with her parents. Then we see her grief and turmoil as she lives through her father's agonising 60-day post-stroke suffering and eventual death in an Auckland nursing home. At sea in the family dynamics, all of them lost without the patriarch's direction, blighted by his now tortured will. She documents it all, the deeply, compulsively felt Dalmatian soul of Nina Vini Nola, finally finding her way through it all to a place of calm, peace and strength. She joins us this morning on Bookends. Tēnā koe, Nina. Thanks so much for joining us.
Kia ora, Marianne. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Cool. So I was, of course, really struck by the strength of the Dalmatian culture. Now, it's not universally well understood in Aotearoa, even though it's such a rich stream in our shared heritage. But also just how intact that culture felt in your childhood experience of it in the 60s in Auckland. You grew up Dalmatian.
Yes, very much so. In fact, I recall when I was a child thinking that we had different coloured blood. And I was very clear about this, that when I went to the doctor for a first blood test and my blood came out red, and I was just horrified. I said, but we have purple blood. And I didn't mean purple as in royal, because I didn't know that association. I just meant different, because I was thinking about this morning when I was thinking about our chat today. And I was thinking that we really were in a bubble, and we went as children to school out of that bubble, and we functioned in mainstream New Zealand society at school with its ethnic mix of children. Although I don't remember Dalmatian children at our primary school, lots of other children, but I think we were one of the only Dalmatian families. And we would come back home, and it was as if we had gone to another world and come back into the world that we knew and that we felt safe and comfortable. And it was very, very contained, because there were so many Dalmatian families and we all did everything together, basically. So almost everyone we knew had an orchard. And so we were all in the same endeavour, the same season, the same rhythms. When the men went fishing, you know, in the West Coast, it was because everyone had finished packing the apples. So it was like very much a shared experience. It mirrors beautifully the original migrants, the Dalmatian migrants to New Zealand, who actually were so successful in their struggle and in their incredible efforts to make something of their lives, because there was so little to make back home. They were successful because they stuck together. And they were so successful sticking together that they were called the Dalmatian locusts, sort of grazing over land and taking all the gum, the kauri gum, out of the ground, because they were family groups, they were village groups, and they supported each other. So that's what I grew up knowing when I was young.
And it's fascinating, because that Dalmatian immigrant kauri gum diggers, I think of that as older history. But we're talking the 60s, and to still have the sense of growing up Dalmatian as opposed to growing up Kiwi really blew my socks off. You know, it was so remarkable. And a new insight for me. So thank you for that. Yeah.
You're very welcome. And I love the way that in your introduction you said that the book is like you're in my soul, in my Dalmatian New Zealand soul, because I really wanted to shine a light on this incredibly strong and close unit community, and then to suggest the tensions there too, and the fact that sometimes you have to break out of that, and sometimes the marginal position or the fringe position, looking back into the community, can be one of great strength and great possibility, because that's what I've done in my life's work. I've stood back. That's why I could write the book. I stood back and looked at the forces at play when I was a child, and then as I was growing up as a young woman trying to assert myself in this patriarchal culture.
Yeah, that's so interesting, Nina. You don't have a sense from reading the book of you standing back. You have a book of being immersed with you in your memory of it in a way that possibly you can only safely allow yourself to do once you have done the business of standing back and gaining that understanding. But the book immerses us with you in your experience of it and your remembered experience of it.
I think that's absolutely correct. I wouldn't have written this book if I hadn't have spent my academic life, my mature years, stepping back and doing academic work on the Croatians in New Zealand and looking, you know, with a semi-critical lens at what this actually meant, so that I could go back into the book or back into the story of the book and be as truthful as I could while creating, I think, a literary document that pays homage to our people. I'm incredibly proud to be Dalmatian, and I can't not be Dalmatian. And sometimes when my sons want to criticize me, they say, oh, you're just a peasant, Mum. And I say, yes, yes. And I'm proud to be of the stock. I'm proud to have my mother as a migrant, you know, in the 50s, and my father's parents as migrants in the early 1900s, and all that they have achieved. And I think there's some of that tension in the book of this desperation to achieve, which means obviously land. It obviously means security. It means providing for the family in terms of fertile, productive endeavour involved in the land, largely.
Yeah, so there's definitely that insight into the community. We see the Dalmatian community in it. There's beautiful photos, and you know, from your childhood experience, there's a lot of love. Obviously, what's interesting to me is you know, your son's calling you a peasant. We absolutely feel your Dalmatian-ness in your passion. And yes. I suppose it's really in that passionate kind of the strength of everything, the strength of every sensation, every emotional sensation is really on the page. And to me, that felt like that was a reflection of something intrinsic about Dalmatian identity without knowing anything before I read the book. Was that a fair takeaway, or is that just you to be that passionate?
I think there's a bit of both. I think right. that I'm incredibly committed in what I do, and I'm in my teaching at the university for 30 years. I was known as being very committed and perhaps a bit dogged. But there's this word in Croatian, which is snaga, and snaga means strength and power and force. And we talk about snaga as something that's, we celebrate snaga. And I think, and partly in this book too, I wanted to show that I suppose I had enough snaga to become an individual myself, yes. And yet I was looking back and honouring the snaga of both my parents in different ways. My mother had incredible quiet power in herself to be able to deal with everything she dealt with as a new migrant, with no language, with no family to support her, thrust into this difficult world of orcharding and working very, very long days. And she married my father, who was the eldest of three brothers. And when I look back at what they achieved, it's phenomenal, and how they worked until they were, my Uncle Wally until he was in his 80s, mid-80s, my Uncle Gus until he was just about 90. They were still capable of working and continuing. And I think there's something to be said for that snaga that is a feature that you've pointed out that you felt from the book.
And obviously there's sometimes so much snaga in a Dalmatian family system that there's that those who are growing into their own strength or, you know, it's very difficult for them to find their place or find a voice. Your mother's passivity and powerlessness through your childhood in that context are a theme in the book. Her own experience of it, your witness to it and attempt to compensate to protect her. I wonder, in your account of the many conversations, she talks about herself. She kind of explains that passivity is simply being exhausted by the demands of the working life and motherhood. But I don't know if you quite see it as simply as that. And I'm just interested to hear more about that.
Well, she was obviously physically exhausted because all the wives were completely and utterly run off their feet, raising children, doing all the work as much as the men did, keeping the house clean. And also there was incredible expectation. I don't know if you've heard about the Croatians' love of laundry. I'm mad on doing laundry. Everything has to be spotlessly clean. Your white has to be whiter than white. When my husband and I went back to Croatia, my auntie looked at his cream trousers and said, Tell your husband to take his trousers off. They came back white, Marianne. They were bleached because they didn't look clean enough.
Fascinating.
So there's this incredible pressure to keep your house spotless. My mother would, she has said to me, I wish I didn't spend all that time washing my floor. I wish I'd spent more time with you children. And I think there was a real conflict there between, she was 17 when she came. She was 17 when she married my father. So she didn't know anything. And she was just trying to do her very best. And she has incredible personal snaga, incredible personal power. But my father was overwhelming. And while there was a lot of love there, the expectations coming from his side of the marriage were the dominant ones, basically.
Very much. I mean, you get, a sense of that, of your father and your mother. You also get this kind of very different family perspectives on the man at the time and now, continue through to the day, different perspectives on your shared history. And with all that snaga and passion, it must have been quite scary to put this version, your version, into the world. And how has it been received by family? Does this play into and exacerbate difficult dynamics, or is it part of a process of coming together for you?
I think that what this book has done is it's exposed things in a way that haven't been looked at in a certain aspect before. It's like shining a new light on everything. And so I have enormous respect from my family, and they were all very proud of me publishing this book. I think everyone would have been happy if I didn't publish the book. I think no one likes a writer in the family who's going to write about the family. I wouldn't like it either. But I think they are honouring the fact that I am shining a new light and trying to look at the subtleties that were at play as we were growing up and that I had to navigate as an adult. And I think that the book has basically taken us to a new level, and I think that we have a new understanding of each other. And my husband hasn't read the second half yet. He got to the first end of the first half and said, oh, something's going to happen. And he put it aside.
Something he didn't already know about.
Yeah.
Having lived through it with you, that's hilarious.
And I said, no. I said, you've got to continue. Yeah. I've had enormous responses from the Croatian community, which is really, really interesting. Many readers have contacted me and then taken me out to coffee as well, which is lovely, saying what I captured on the early years of Henderson and the dynamics of being Croatian in New Zealand, later with the problems with my father in hospital and the forces that we were trying to deal with and the authority figures, etc. Everyone unanimously has said how it rings true. And that's just really, it was really important to me that I captured something that other Croatians would recognise. And I've had that feedback, which is just fabulous as a writer.
That's marvellous to hear. The way you portray your relationship to your dad, there's this. There's two things. There's this kind of real celebration, almost a kind of a glorification of the man, his energy and his enthusiasms, his larger-than-lifeness. But the book takes that pride in him, but it also really deals with the unhealthy aspects of his power and control within the family. Where are you in that now?
In relation to my father?
In relation to your father and in relation to that kind of, how much the pedestal and then the reality. How do you balance those things in yourself?
I have no problem balancing those things, which is probably a product of the process of writing the book. Now, the book was written quite quickly. I started in 2007 when my father was lying hemiplegic, having suffered the major stroke, and I was holding his left hand with my left hand, his good side, and writing with my right hand. And I filled four notebooks over the 60 days that he was in hospital. And I actually thought they were just going to be a medical record and things that the family might look back on. And then I realized as I was writing that towards the end of the, book three, book four, they became much more about what had actually happened in the family coming up to this point. And I think I put everything away because I needed that space to look back and reflect on how I was seeing my father and how I portray and navigate this overwhelming power. Everyone knew of him as having this incredible quality. Mm. Wonderful if it works for you, and scary if it works against you. It's not, it wasn't physical. For me, it was never physical. Mm. It was just emotional and power. And, you know, the notion, you know, when he squeezed me at the wedding when we were dancing together and said, you know, I cherish you, and that cherish, it was just too close for me. I loved my father and he loved me, but we needed to have that space so that he could let me become the woman I needed to become myself. So when I look back now, I feel only love. I feel absolute enormous gratitude that I had those 60 days sitting with him as he lay dying. And I feel that he, if he were to come back, he would come back with a tempered edges. I would can imagine that he would actually soften some of his methods. But he was incredibly successful. And actually, someone came up to one of my book events in Auckland, and he bought a book, and I said, "Oh, I don't have enough change." He said, "Oh no, I don't need change." He said, "Your father helped me so much. You've got no idea how many ways your father helped me." Mm. And I think that there was that generosity and that civic side to him that is an example of the good side of that power that he had.
There, obviously, an enormous man, an enormous impact on yourself, a fabulous insight into a community that we don't celebrate enough. There's so much to talk more to talk about, but we don't have any more time. So I am going to have to wrap this up with thanking you very much for joining us, Nina. I hope the swimming and the fishing are excellent for you in Whangateo.
Yes, thank you.
And on Hawa for the long years to come. Did I say that right?
You said that beautifully, Marianne. Well done.
The book is How to Spell Love by Nina Vini Nola. It's published by Cuba Press and it's available in bookstores nationwide.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.